I don't know if you realize that the speakers have to do quite a sprint to get up here. So by the time we arrive, we're out of breath. Now, I didn't spend all of my jokes yesterday, you know that. The meek shall inherit the earth. I think you have gathered from now that the proposition in all of this is that the order of Baha'u'llah is that inheritance which has been provided for the meek, and that it offers the masses a means of universal participation in advancing the efforts towards a world civilization. Now, yesterday we ended up trying to explore the idea of this order and what it means, and concluding in a way that the principles of such an order obviously cover whatever efforts we make in social and economic development, and that we ought to learn about them so that we can use them effectively in this work. Now, we ended up exploring the order, and as we began to appreciate the wonder of it all, we asked the question, how is this awesome reality to be realized? And I think we ended at the point where we are saying, thank you. Let me see, this water needs a place to rest. How is the administrative order to be realized? And we ended by saying that the reality and benefits of such an order can be realized only if we recognize our contractual arrangement with Baha'u'llah, and then by endeavoring to fulfill our part of the contract. And we quoted from the hidden words, you know, love me that I may love thee. If thou lovest me not, my love can in no wise reach thee, which in fact explains the contract rather marvelously and sweetly. Now, at the very heart of this contract, we concluded, is the covenant of Baha'u'llah. So I want to continue now by discussing something about the covenant. Now, the covenant of Baha'u'llah, as I understand it, is the latest extension of the original covenant made by God with his human creatures. The basic covenant is the ancient arrangement by which God promised to send us divine guidance through his messengers. These messengers appear at different intervals of human history. We become a party to the covenant when we recognize the manifestation of God for our time. Each manifestation reinforces this ancient understanding by the arrangement he makes with his people. Now, with specific reference to the covenant of Baha'u'llah, Shoghi Effendi explains that it has two forms. The first is the covenant that every prophet makes with humanity, or more definitely, with his people, that they will accept and follow the coming manifestation, who will be the reappearance of his reality. Now, as you know, Baha'u'llah has told us, not until after 1,000 years will such a reappearance occur. Then the Guardian goes on to say, the second form of covenant is such as the one that Baha'u'llah made with his people, that they should accept the Master. The Master, of course, Abdu'l-Bahá. Under the same category falls the covenant the Master made with the Baha'is, that they should accept his administration after him. That ends the statement from the Guardian or from his secretary. That's published in Baha'i News, way back, number 80, page 5, if you want to make a note of that. Now, the purpose of the covenant, in a sense, is to keep humanity connected to divine reality from age to age. This divine reality is a reference, at least in my mind, to the one source, the one truth, the one faith, as revealed to humanity in stages, in accordance with the ability of souls to comprehend. This reality is thus progressively revealed with the successive appearances of the manifestations of God. Now, with each appearance, we seem to invent a new religion, but the whole point is that there's one faith, and you have these different chapters with the manifestations coming. But our history and the circumstances of life on earth have not aided us to appreciate that singular point until now, when we have a whole world that has been discovered. In another sense, the purpose of the covenant is to ensure the fulfillment of God's will for the human race. Now, there are two documents that contain the provisions of the Baha'i Covenant. The Kitab-i-Ad, which Baha'u'llah wrote with his own hand, and Kitab-i-Ad means the book of my covenant. And then there's the Will and Testament, which of Abdu'l-Bahá, which he wrote in his own hand. Documents are closely related. Reading them in tandem and considering their contents together make their inseparable relationship clear. The Will and Testament, I see, as I understand it, completes our understanding of the Kitab-i-Ad and certain provisions of the Kitab-i-Aqdas itself. Now, if you read them together, you say, you will see that Baha'u'llah has made certain points in his Kitab-i-Ad, which Abdu'l-Bahá amplifies in the Will and Testament. I don't have a moment now or the time now to go through it with you. If I did, I would go through the whole exercise and show it to you. The Will and Testament completes our understanding of the Kitab-i-Ad and certain provisions of the Kitab-i-Aqdas itself. That's what I said earlier. Generally, our discussion of the covenant focuses on certain provisions, on which special emphasis is, of course, due. These have principally to do with such matters as successorship, the authority to interpret and to legislate, and protection of the faith. These are, of course, of fundamental importance. And at the time of the passing of Abdu'l-Bahá, were emphasized up until this day, and they deserve emphasis. But there is far more to the covenant than these. Appreciation of its other provisions is necessary if we are to appreciate the comprehensiveness of its purpose. Now, this is not the occasion to elaborate on this subject, and so a few details must suffice for now. In the Kitab-i-Ad, Baha'u'llah reaffirms his appointment of Abdu'l-Bahá as his successor. He's the center of the covenant. I say reaffirm because this is stated in the Kitab-i-Aqdas itself. This, of course, this provision is an indescribable prize among Baha'u'llah's bequests to humankind. Among Baha'u'llah's other bequests are the principle and goal of the oneness of humankind. The very second paragraph of the Kitab-i-Ad tells us that the reason that he went through all of this suffering is to bring us this unity, to bring harmony to the world. One of these bequests is also the administrative institutions. And then you have indispensable guidance regarding the prerequisites for success. spiritual and material, as well as our relationships to one another and to society. He tells us how to relate to kings, how to relate to one another, what to do about society. Now, included in this guidance is his admonition to us to serve all nations and to strive for the betterment of the world. That's in the Kitab-i-An. He says, we admonish you to serve all nations and to strive for the betterment of the world. This is, of course, enormously important to our considerations of social and economic development. Now, in the Will and Testament of Abdu'l-Bahá tells us how the wondrous system, remember that statement by Bahá'u'lláh in the Kitab-i Aqdas, how this wondrous system is to be realized. The Will and Testament extends, for instance, the function of authorized interpretation in the appointment of Shoghi Effendi as guardian. It explains for the first time in any literature of the faith how the Universal House of Justice is to be established. You know, that Bahá'u'lláh tells us about the House of Justice in his writings. He keeps referring things to the Universal House of Justice. He tells us that God will verily inspire them with whatsoever he willeth, but he doesn't tell us how it will come about. You go to the Will and Testament and you find that out. This is part of the completion of the arrangement of the Aqdas and the Kitab-i-Ad, those arrangements. Now, in this connection also, the matter of establishing the House of Justice and telling us what its functions should be. In this connection, the Will and Testament also reveals the necessity of secondary houses of justice, which we know now as national spiritual assemblies. The members of these secondary houses of justice are the electors of that supreme body. The Will and Testament instructs us as to how the faith is to be protected. It tells us to teach the faith. It elaborates much of the guidance given in the Kitab-i-Ad. Now, taken together, the provisions of these two documents complete the structure of the covenant of Baha'u'llah, and we are able, both from their texts and from the actions of Abdu'l-Bahá as the exemplar of the teachings, to derive an appreciation of its uniqueness and dynamism. Instruction and experience have made the efficacy of the covenant quite clear, whether as the harbinger of unity or as the very bastion of the faith. The covenant, as we have learned from Abdu'l-Bahá, is indeed the axis of world unity. All that we do revolves around it. The covenant incorporates the essentials of the faith. It connects souls with Baha'u'llah and his purpose. From this connection, these souls derive the divine confirmations that nourish their faith and energize their efforts. The covenant unites peoples. It trains and prepares human resources. Just read it and see what instructions we get from the two documents. It activates and sustains the system that guarantees success of the plan of God in our time. In other words, it applies practice to principle with a coherence that translates the central theme of the Baha'i revelation into a living and universal reality. The covenant is the ultimate guide for teaching and administration of the faith. Now, Abdu'l-Bahá, as the center of the covenant, is the divinely chosen instrument that connects all elements of the revelation in a workable plan of action. His will and testament, Shoghi Effendi states, should be regarded as the perpetual, the indissoluble link which the mind of him who is the mystery of God, who is the mystery of God? Abdu'l-Bahá, Baha'u'lláh called him the mystery of God. Who is the mystery of God has conceived in order to ensure the continuity of the three ages that constitute the component parts of the Baha'i dispensation. Now, what are these three ages? We know the heroic age, the period in which Baha'u'llah, the Bab and Baha'u'llah and Abdu'l-Bahá lived, and the great period for massive martyrdoms, that period, and then the period that followed that after the passing of Abdu'l-Bahá, the formative age in which we now live, meaning this is the age of building, this is the age of shaping the institutions and moving towards a world order, world civilization. And then the third is the golden age, which we hope will be attained in due course. Now, so Abdu'l-Bahá's role, the things that he did, the way that he lived, connected all of these things, because he gave us the explanations, he gave us the full picture of the structure that should guide our actions until the next manifestation of God arrives on the planet. The center of the covenant, indeed, has left detailed explanations and instructions, both for teaching and for the operation of an administrative order. Now, if the covenant is the axis of the oneness of humankind, Abdu'l-Bahá is at the very center of that axis, both as interpreter and exemplar. Interpreter of the word, he is, with respect to the means of realizing the oneness of mankind. He translates the meaning of the word into intention and deeds, telling us how to activate the divinely ordained system that is to usher in the new world order envisioned by Baha'u'llah. He also translates meaning in relation to personal conduct by exemplifying the principles, or you might say the virtues, of the revelation in his own life. So we have both the theory of it and the practice of it and the example of it in Abdu'l-Bahá. In his person, as in his words, the covenant becomes a living ideal manifested in both mystical and practical terms. Remember, it was the president of Stanford University, when Abdu'l-Bahá spoke there, described Abdu'l-Bahá as a person who tread the mystical path with practical feet. Thus, he is the medium between word and outcome in all the implied purposes of the covenant. Meaning is realized in deed, action, system, structure. Abdu'l-Bahá is the very embodiment of the covenant. Absent Abdu'l-Bahá, the world order of Baha'u'llah would not exist. The reality of the covenant would remain hidden. All right, let us return briefly to Baha'u'llah's admonition in the book of his covenant. Serve all nations and strive for the betterment of the world. A response of the Universal House of Justice to this imperative of the covenant is given in its message to the Baha'i world, dated 20 October 1983. In which it directs attention to the need for for Baha'i action in advancing social and economic development throughout the world. The message legitimizes Baha'i involvement in social and economic development by showing that this is congruent with the central principle of the Baha'i faith, which of course is the oneness of humankind. To reinforce the oneness of mankind, it states, this letter, this message, implies the achievement of a dynamic coherence between the spiritual and practical requirements of life on earth. I'll read that again. The oneness of mankind implies the achievement of a dynamic coherence between the spiritual and practical requirements of life on earth. Now, to reinforce this assertion, the message goes on to say, the indispensability of this coherence is unmistakably illustrated in Baha'u'llah's ordination of the Mashaqallah's car, the spiritual center of every Baha'i community, round which must flourish dependencies dedicated to the social, humanitarian, educational, and scientific advancement of mankind. Of course, we're talking about the house of worship in each case. And we know that the dependencies include what? Orphanage, home for the aged, university, and all of that. Institutions that cater to the welfare of the human race and the development of the human race. And thus, the House of Justice loses no time in driving home the point that, quote, the concept of social and economic development is enshrined in the sacred teachings of our faith. Simply stated, it is inseparable from the covenant. Has Baha'u'llah not said in the Eshakat that the progress of the world, the development of nations, the tranquility of peoples, and the peace of all who dwell on earth are among the principles and ordinances of God? He said this. Now that the vital importance of social and economic development has been verified, how is it to be done? How is it to be done? A major paragraph of this message speaks directly to the point, and I think you must be familiar with this. It says, now, after all the years of constant teaching activity, the community of the greatest name has grown to the stage at which the processes of this development must be incorporated into its regular pursuits. It goes on to say that the steps to be taken must necessarily begin in the Baha'i community itself, with the friends endeavoring through their application of spiritual principles, their rectitude of conduct, and the practice of the art of consultation to uplift themselves and thus become self-sufficient and self-reliant. This is a very important point. And in countries where people are not as developed as we think we are here, these principles hold and do produce the kinds of results that we hope for in this respect. Moreover, the message goes on, these are exertions will conduce to the preservation of human honor, so desired by Baha'u'llah. So you see, the question of social and economic development is concerned not only with the material development of people, but also the spiritual concepts involved of honor, of dignity, and so on. in the process, and as a consequence, the message goes on, the friends will undoubtedly extend the benefits of their efforts to society as a whole until all mankind achieves the progress intended by the Lord of the age. And then the House of Justice informs us of a vital point. It says progress in the development field will depend largely on natural stirrings at the grassroots, and it should receive its driving force from those sources rather than from an imposition of plans and programs from the top. I was just reading an article in the New York Times recently about some efforts in Afghanistan to develop people. And they found that where the local people were allowed to discuss their concerns and to make decisions about them, that things were beginning to work. In other circumstances where dollars were thrown at them and the big boys came in and told them what to do, things failed. I have the article, I don't want to read it to you, but it's in my sack here. Now, who is responsible for undertaking this effort? We know from the House of Justice that the National Spiritual Assemblies are called upon to take well-conceived measures to involve the thought and actions of local spiritual assemblies and individuals in the devising and implementing of plans within the constraints, and this is important, within the constraints of existing circumstances and available resources. In other words, we shouldn't go beyond the possibilities of our resources and our circumstances, but certainly we should strive. And it then tells us that ultimately, the call to action is addressed to the individual friends, whether they be adult or youth, veteran or newly enrolled. So this whole exercise, this whole development, this work is something that involves us all, whatever our age, if we have the heart and the will to act. The House of Justice says, let them step forth. That is, these individuals, adults and youth, let them step forth to take their places in the arena of service, where their talents and skills, their specialized training, their material resources, their offers of time and energy, and above all, their dedication to Baha'i principles can be put to work in improving the lot of man. You see, we cannot act without principles to guide our actions and to open up possibilities for us. So then, what are the principles that enable action, or the actions to which the message refers? We are told spiritual principles. Well, this is a framework. Among these principles we have, for instance, equality of men and women, the equality of the sexes, elimination of prejudice, these kinds of things that you know, and I don't have to recite them. But then the House of Justice specifies in its early paragraph on this thing, two, rectitude of conduct and consultation. Now, this rectitude of conduct is the rubric under which Shoghi Effendi discusses principles of justice, equity, honesty, fair-mindedness, truthfulness, trustworthiness, reliability. Speaking of justice, Baha'u'llah, as you know, has told us in the hidden words that this is the best beloved of all things in his sight. And he tells us individually how to behave in terms of carrying out that principle. And he tells us in another of his writings, he says, what this wronged one doth expect from everyone is justice and fairness. So the House of Justice is calling our attention to this rectitude of conduct, which, by the way, is mentioned two or three times in the Will and Testament of Abdu'l-Bahá. And it is in this advent of divine justice that we find a full discussion of the meaning of rectitude of conduct. Now, as to consultation, the art of consultation, as the House of Justice states it, that involves collective engagement in reaching understandings, initiating efforts, and resolving problems. It is, to be sure, a major element of the key to success in social and economic development. So if we are to exploit the stirrings at the grassroots, we must hear from the people, and to hear from the people is to consult, to encourage them to consult among themselves, and to hear the results of such consultation. I think then that we should ponder for a while what is meant by the art of consultation, since it is so vital to the whole process. I think it's time for a joke. It's number two. All right, that's good. Think about it. Now, about consultation, we know that the dictionary tells us that it means discussing, discussion, it means taking counsel, seeking advice, and such. It means all of that to us in our faith. Baha'u'llah says, in all things it is necessary to consult. In all things it is necessary to consult. Then he says, this matter should be forcibly stressed. This matter should be forcibly stressed, this matter of consultation being all important, so that consultation may be observed by all, he says. The intent, he goes on, of what hath been revealed from the pen of the Most High is that consultation may be fully carried out among the friends, inasmuch as it is and will always be a cause of awareness and of awakening and a source of good and well-being. He wants us to forcibly stress the importance of this thing. Abdu'l-Bahá tells us, settle all things, both great and small, by consultation. Settle all things, both great and small, by consultation. Then Baha'u'llah engages us in a discussion of consultation. He puts a frame to it that is most interesting, I find. And all of these are in this compilation on consultation that's available to you. Baha'u'llah says, no man can attain his true station except through his justice. Right? In other words, the person has to be just to attain his full station. He says, no power can exist except through unity. No welfare, he goes on, and no well-being can be attained except through consultation. No well-being, no welfare. Now, all of these elements of justice and unity are indispensable to consultation. And the consultation reinforces unity, and it enables the use of power that comes from that unity in the right way, in making use of the results from that consultation. And justice is implied is applied to the whole process of consultation. We have to be fair-minded, we have to have equity, and so on and so on. Now, about justice, I was struck by a statement that Baha'u'llah has made. He says that he that is unjust in his judgment is destitute of the characteristics that distinguish man's station. Critical piece of information here. He that is unjust in his judgment is destitute of the characteristics that distinguishes man's station. Our rulers should bear this in mind. So, no welfare and no well-being can be attained except through consultation. Baha'u'llah tells us it is a cause of awareness and of awakening. He says it is a lamp of guidance which leads the way. He calls it the bestower of understanding. He says it is a shining light which in a dark world leadeth the way and guideth. And I like this particular statement that he makes of it. He says it transmutes conjecture into certitude. It takes the guesswork out of things. It transmutes conjecture into certitude. The maturity of the gift of understanding is made manifest through consultation. The heaven of the divine wisdom is illumined, he says, with the two luminaries of consultation and compassion. Now, what does this combination mean? Consultation and compassion. He says that the heaven of divine wisdom is illumined with these two luminaries, consultation and compassion. What does compassion have to do with this? With justice and so on. And yet it does have a lot to do with it. The way that my take on this part of the compassion thing is that, you know, the institutions do have to consult on cases where people have broken the law. And sometimes these people deserve punishment. Now, where does the compassion come in if you're going to punish somebody? The fact of the matter, I think, is that in all that we do, in every consideration that we make about things and about people, we should bear one thing in mind at all times, that these are creatures, these people are creatures of God, that they have souls, that they are entitled to their dignity and their honor. And so whatever we do in relation to them, whether it's the institution in terms of punishing them or whatever, we must preserve the dignity and the honor and have concern for the spiritual essence of people. Now, the punishment is perhaps well-deserved and it can be administered without robbing that person of his dignity. It's a very important concept for us to contemplate. Now, consultation is applied in our individual lives, in our personal activities, as well as in our institutional and administrative life. Now, let's look a little bit at the administrative involvement and relationship of this. Shoghi Effendi tells us, consultation, frank and unfettered, is the bedrock of this unique order. Consultation, frank. Look at his descriptions here. Frank and unfettered. Frank means you must tell the truth. You know, sometimes in consultation, we want to protect others. We don't want to embarrass them, or we don't want to appear to be ratting on somebody, and we hold back information from the institutions. That's not frankness. That's deception. Unfettered means we should be free to speak, and I will get into that later on. The Guardian goes on to say also that the principle of consultation, which constitutes one of the basic laws of the administration, should be applied to all Baha'i activities which affect the collective interests of the faith. For it is through cooperation and continued exchange of thoughts and views that the cause can best safeguard and foster its interests. So an aspect of consultation is, of course, cooperation. Now, how do the institutions do this? And I think that by discussing the institutions and what they do, we gain a proper sense of how we, in our individual lives, might conduct consultation. We quote from Abdu'l-Bahá in terms of the actions of assemblies, spiritual assemblies. He says, the prime requisites for them that take counsel together are purity of motive, radiance of spirit, detachment from all else save God, attraction to his divine fragrances, humility and lowliness amongst his loved ones, patience and long suffering in difficulties, and servitude to his exalted threshold. Now that says it all. Now friends, think about this. You're going into a room to make a decision, 9 of you. And you know that you have to apply the laws and the principles to the decisions you have to make. But what Abdu'l-Bahá is telling us here is that that's not enough. Those are the mechanics of getting decisions made. But you have a spirit to decision making, which is incredibly important. Purity of motive, for instance. Purity of motive. Think of that. Why are you doing what you're doing? Why are you saying what you're saying? Why are you deciding what you're deciding? What spirit do you take to this? Your intention is to fulfill the will of God, to take care of his people, to take care of his order, to make sure that it works. That is the motive, to serve him. That has to go into the consideration. Radiance of spirit, how do you achieve that? Consultation in assemblies can be pretty rugged and pretty, you know, disturbing. How do you maintain radiance of spirit? Well, for whom are you working? It's through the teachings, the elevation that comes from understanding the teachings. And this radiance of spirit, think of what a local spiritual assembly represents. Baha'u'llah tells us in the Kitab-i Aqdas and other tablets that the members of these institutions, and I'm talking about the local houses of justice, the local spiritual assemblies, should regard themselves as the guardians of all who dwell on earth. He says that they should, when they enter their meetings, they should consider that they are entering the presence of God. Furthermore, he says that the glances of God are directed towards that assembly. Abdu'l-Bahá tells us that he spreads his wings over the local spiritual assemblies. He calls them lamps that shine, that illumine their jurisdiction. He says that they are the potent sources of the progress of man at all times and under all conditions. Now, with that kind of understanding, you can afford to maintain radiance of spirit. When that spiritual, those 9 people go into their council chamber and call upon God and pray and do their business, they have access to the divine. The glances of God are directed towards that assembly, Baha'u'llah says. We should be very careful how we regard these institutions. Just because our bodies are on it doesn't mean that we should, you know, treat them as our bodies. I mean, treat the institution as our body. It's not our body. It's the institution that God has put in our midst. It is the nucleus, to me, of the civilization which is to be raised in any jurisdiction. And we better have a proper respect for them. All right. So radiance of spirit. Think about that. Detachment from all else save God. In other words, you have no personalities that you're attached to when you're in the meeting. You are there to deal with questions of truth and fact. Justice now is a very important thing here. Justice, equity, honesty, fair-mindedness. So if you're sitting in an assembly meeting and it has to do with something that a brother or a sister did that was wrong, you can't afford to be defending that there. You have to detach yourself from brother, sister. You have to hook yourself to the principles and the laws and act as if you are one of the trustees of the merciful. Humility. The Guardian once told us in one of his letters that the members of spiritual assemblies shouldn't consider themselves as the ornaments of the faith. In other words, they know better than everybody else and they're prancing around and sparkling like. Lowliness. The members of the spiritual assembly are brothers and sisters. And so on. So you see the point I'm making. Now he tells us this. The members thereof must take counsel together. In other words, consult. In such wise that no occasion for ill feeling or discord may arise. This can be attained when every member expresses with absolute freedom his own opinion and setteth forth his argument. Should anyone oppose, he must on no account feel hurt. For not until matters are fully discussed can the right way be revealed. You see. In other words, don't get upset if somebody disagrees. What is the point here? He says, the shining spark of truth cometh forth only after the clash of differing opinions. So we can afford to have warfare with ideas and opinions in our council chambers. It's the only occasion in which we are permitted to have a clash in matters, because Baha'u'llah has forbidden conflict and contention in our relationships. He says, if after discussion a decision be carried unanimously, well and good. But if the Lord forbid differences of opinion should arise, a majority of voices must prevail. Now elsewhere he tells us that we should not, if we were in the minority in the question, go out of the meeting and criticize the decision of the majority, because this is not a proper way to do things. In fact, after the majority have decided, the minority joins them in carrying out the decision that's been made. Now, we also know that the decision of an assembly could possibly be wrong. But so what? He says that if they agree upon a subject, that is, if they agree because there's purity of motive, they've gone in, they've done the things properly. If they agree upon a subject, even though it be wrong, it is better than to disagree and be in the right. For this difference will produce the demolition of the divine foundation. He says, though one of the parties may be on the right and they disagree, that will be the cause of 1,000 wrongs. But if they agree and both parties are in the wrong, as it is in unity, the truth will be revealed and the wrong made right. Now that is a matter of faith as well. The Guardian tells us, he says, we all have a right to our opinions. We are bound to think differently. But a Baha'i must accept the majority decision of his assembly, realizing that acceptance and harmony, even if a mistake has been made, are the really important thing. And when we serve the cause properly in the Baha'i way, God will right any wrongs done in the end. Now, this is a very different way of thinking from the way the world thinks. And I'm now going to read to you a quote that I discovered many, many years ago. I was at in the library in Greenacre reading old issues of The Star of the West, and I came upon this quote. It actually changed my life in a certain way and made it easy for me to function on institutions. Listen to what Abdu'l-Bahá is saying here. He says, "Blessed are they who are the means of making unity among the friends, and pity on those who in their right or wrong are the cause of discord." For instance, when one is in the right in a case, in dispute, and his minority prevents him from establishing this rightful matter, instead of agitating the subject, if he will humbly submit to sacrifice his position for the sake of unity and peace, God will accept that sacrifice, and ere long, the rightful matter will be established without any further dispute. Have you ever heard a thing like this? That in consultation, assuming that you are right, you can't get the majority to agree, you make sure that you've explained yourself fully. That's not the point. You should. But once you've done it, if the others don't get it and they're doing other things, don't agitate. God will accept this submissiveness as a sacrifice from you. This is an amazing thing. This is a matter of faith. You see then that it relaxes your nerves and you don't have to get so excited about your opinions. And sometimes you are wrong anyhow. I mean, I have experienced situations where, you know, I have a great idea, toss it on the table and leave it out there, and it gets knocked around by the others. By the time, you know, it goes for two or three rounds, you realize that you were very foolish, and you yourself turn around and vote against your own idea. So, friends, this is the nature of consultation, the institutions. Individuals should practice it in the same spirit. You know, for instance, that there are different occasions for consultation. For elected institutions that have to make decisions that we have to obey and follow, and for appointed corporate bodies in the faith, the object of the consultation of elected corporate bodies is to do what? To make decisions. They're supposed to make decisions that will lead to action. The object of other bodies, such as the 19-day feast, the unit convention, the national convention, and so on, and the annual meeting in your local community, the object of this is to do what? To offer advice and recommendations to the institutions. It is fascinating that the cause allows us, any one of us, to present an idea in the proper setting. And that idea, if agreed to by our fellow believers through consultation, as the first level of processing. You don't just willy-nilly send a million ideas to the institutions. There's a way of processing them and winnowing them down, bringing them to measurable levels. Then that goes to the institutions that have the obligation to consider them. Now for individuals, well, I'll wait for the individuals. The Guardian tells us this about all of this discussion and consultation. He says, "Let us remember that at the very root of the cause lies the principle of the undoubted right of the individual to self-expression, his freedom to declare his conscience and set forth his views." We know, for instance, that sometimes we have critical things to say, and the faith allows us to criticize certain things in the proper setting. In the case of the 19-day feast, if you feel something is going wrong, you have a right to say so. But listen to how you do it. The House of Justice wrote about this in a message that it addressed to this community in 1988, and it's published under Individual Rights and Freedoms in the World Order of Baha'u'llah. The House of Justice says, the administrative order provides channels for expression of criticism, acknowledging as a matter of principle that, and it's quoting from the Guardian now, it is not only the right, but the vital responsibility of every loyal and intelligent member of the community to offer fully and frankly, but with due respect and consideration of the authority of the assembly, any suggestion, recommendation, or criticism he conscientiously feels he should in order to improve and remedy certain existing conditions or trends in the local community. Correspondingly, the assembly has the duty to give careful consideration, as the Guardian says, to any such views submitted to them. So there you have it. We're all free to speak, but the manner in which we speak is important, both inside institutions and outside of them. Now, for individuals, the Master tells us that we should consult. He says that consultation is one of the explicit ordinances of the Lord of the age. He says the purpose of consultation is to show that the views of several individuals are assuredly preferable to one man's, even as the power of a number of men is, of course, greater than the power of one man. Thus, consultation, he goes on, is acceptable in the presence of the Almighty and hath been enjoined upon the believers so that they may confer upon ordinary and personal matters as well as on affairs which are general in nature and universal. He goes on to give us an example. He says, for instance, when a man hath a project to accomplish, should he consult with some of his brethren, that which is agreeable and will of course be investigated and unveiled to his eyes, and the truth will be disclosed. Likewise, on a higher level, should the people of a village consult one another about their affairs, the right solution will certainly be revealed. In like manner, the members of each profession, such as in industry, should consult, and those in commerce should similarly consult on business affairs. In short, consultation is desirable and acceptable in all things and on all issues. Now, have you noticed of late that we have grown a crop of consultants? That business is doing more consulting than ever before? Don't you think that the spirit of the age of the teachings have caught up with society and they're doing this thing? So the Master says, settle all things, both great and small, by consultation. Without prior consultation, take no personal step in your own personal affairs. All right, let's come to a conclusion about all of this. Here are some of my own opinions about consultation and what it means to me. I don't know what you think of it. Take this as a block of salt, I don't care. For me, consultation is a civilizing instrument. It's the greatest means for tapping the collective genius of the human mind for the common good. It transforms genius into practical achievements. It enables people to chart the course and set the pace of their development. It is a mighty tool in the hands of the weak, a measure of upliftment for all. Sure, it is the surest means, so far as I see, for determining the destiny of peoples, in that it enables people to take charge of their affairs, no matter how humble their circumstances. If I had time, I'd tell you a story about a local assembly that was 2 years old and how they were able to do some things that was, to me, quite astonishing. Consultation guarantees the progress of humanity at any level and at any time. It's a powerful means of evolutionary development and revolutionary action. It civilizes and planetizes our relationships. I also see it as a discipline of social organization that moderates the extremes of human passion. It transfers war from the battlefield to the council chamber, where the clash of opinions produces the sparks. In other words, it transmutes war into peace. No longer do we have to march into the battle on the battlefield and shoot each other down. Now, this consultation also, to my mind, lends practical value to unity as an instrument of progress. No consultation. What do you do with all this lovey-dovey stuff, all this unity and all being together? Doesn't mean anything unless you can produce progress from it. It is the channel through which unity exerts its influence as a force for progress. It ensures the resilience and flexibility by which the forces of social evolution are canalized towards constructive ends. I'm done?
No, you're not.
Oh. What?
Better news is that he's not done.
Yeah.
You have 15 more minutes, so.
All right. All right, very good. Now, friends, I got a little leave here. I have some minutes. I'll tell you about the story when I said that that it is the surest means for determining the destinies of people, in that it enables people to take charge of their affairs, no matter how humble their circumstances. That it is a mighty tool in the hands of the weak. In 1984 or 5, thereabouts, the House of Justice received a letter from a National Spiritual Assembly in one of the so-called third world countries. And the Assembly was extremely excited in what it had to report to the House of Justice. It was about an assembly that was just 2 months old. It was a village assembly. All the members were illiterate. They got together to meet in the early period of their ministry, those first 2 months. And one of the points that came up in their consultation was that Baha'u'llah had instructed that children should be educated. So this local assembly is saying, what are we to do about this? Remember, none of them can read. They decided, so they talked about it. One of the members of the assembly said, you know, I don't have much. I have this little plot of ground where I have my little house. But I'm willing to allow the assembly to build a room on the space next to my house as a classroom for children. Now, you have to think of what has happened here. The assembly starts out with zero, and now it has created some muster. It's got land it can do something with. So they discuss what they should do about this classroom, the building this room and all of that. And then they have to discuss what is to be done about the teaching part, because we don't read, we don't know anything. We have to find somebody who can teach them. And so somehow or another, they rack their brains, and they decided on somebody. I don't know whether it was a Baha'i or not, man or woman, who would be asked to teach their children. The question is, if this person is going to take time away from his or her whatever livelihood, whatever work he's doing to teach their children, how is this person to live? So they decided among themselves, okay, we will do things. We are farmers here and so on. We will do a little more and produce food and things to help this person so that they don't have to worry about their livelihood. Then they talked about Some of them offered to go into the bush and catch monkeys and take them to the marketplace and sell them to buy chalk and chalkboard for the children and so on. You know, this thing is years ago, but it has made such an impression on my mind, I remember every detail of it. I won't tell you all the details. The one thing that stumped them was that they didn't know what their children should be taught exactly, the curriculum. So they decided, we better ask the National Assembly that question. Now look at what has happened here, friends. This group of people decided to take their destiny into their hands, to decide what they needed, how they would go about producing that need, and where they couldn't answer a question, they knew where to turn to get an answer. That to me was the beginning of civilization in that village. They have big ideas. For instance, I don't know, they must have had a marvelous pioneer that taught them, because they decided that they wanted to have a conference on women. Now it was, I think, the year preceding the International Year of Women. How they heard about that, only God knows in the bush there. But they did. And they wanted a conference. And I wanted you to know that in this letter here, it explained what they were going to do to have this conference, including getting youth to usher the guests that they would bring in, and even preparing starched sheets on which their guests would sleep. It's all in that report. Then they looked around and they didn't like the scruffiness of their village. It needed fixing. They said, we better clean up this place. So, there's an example for you. Raw like that. The assembly was 2 months old. So let me go on. The Baha'i principles of consultation set a new standard for public discourse. I wish we could teach our public officials how to do this. It is not a mere social mechanism for decision making. It is a sure and accessible means of engaging the Holy Spirit in the ordinary affairs of humankind. Now, isn't that something? Isn't that something? We can actually attract the divine presence when our institutions go into this consultation. As Baha'u'llah says, they should regard themselves as entering the presence of God. Now, properly conducted, consultation invites the presence and intervention of the divine. As we know, in the case of local and national assemblies, they get guidance. In the case of the House of Justice, it gets guidance and it is guaranteed infallibility. So what might we conclude? Consultation is a gift of God to our age and is the birthright of every human being. Truly an inheritance that empowers the meek. Right? Okay. So, shall the meek inherit the earth? Baha'u'llah has laid out the plan and said, here it is, kids, take it. Now, for an assurance of hope in our efforts in social and economic development, I quote from The Guardian, and the House of Justice also quoted in its letter. This is what he said in 1933 to the friends. He says, the problems which confront the believers at the present time, whether social, spiritual, economic, or administrative, will be gradually solved as the number and the resources of the friends multiply and their capacity for service and for the application of Baha'i principles develops. They should be patient, confident, and active in utilizing every possible opportunity that presents itself within the limits now necessarily imposed upon them. May the Almighty, he says, aid them to fulfill their highest hopes. So, friends, that ends my whole discourse. Is there time for a question or two? Or do we...
There's 10 minutes.
10 minutes, okay, come on. If you have a question or so, I'm willing to take a chance with it. Yes, somebody's advancing to the microphone here. Yeah.
Testing? Yeah.
Oh, yes. It's awesome.
It works. Speak loudly because the friends sometimes can't hear from those microphones.
Good morning.
Good morning.
It's not really a question.
All right.
I just wanted to thank you. It was a wonderful talk.
I appreciate it. Okay. You see, if you hadn't prayed for me, I wouldn't have come. So you owe it to yourselves and your prayers.
I'm struggling with trying to learn to use a consultative method with people in the world who are not as interested in being truthful or in justice.
Right.
And I feel like I've come to some understanding of consultation in our assembly, in my community, in my marriage, but I am just clueless with using a consultative method in this other kind of context.
Yes. Yeah. Well, this person is trying to see how it is possible to use the principles of consultation or to engage people outside of the assembly experience that she has or her own personal experience at home, the people out there, how to engage them in this. Well, that is something that you will have to work on depending on how you judge the circumstance in which you find yourself. The fact of the matter is that the world is turning towards consultation. Businesses have adopted this as a major means of progress. And I think that it depends on how you get into it. Rather than preaching to them about it, maybe you could invite them into a discussion without telling them what you're doing. And just say, listen, we have this headache here. Let's talk about it. What do you think? Bring them together and just practice it. And then gradually you can give them pointers as to how to make a success of it. I don't know what else to say.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Recently we've had the opportunity to participate in a talk or a course called The Cluster and the Covenant.
Uh-huh.
And in the process, we began to see a little bit more clearly how the insertion of agencies have been inserted into the administrative order, and been told that it's still not somewhat clear exactly what the roles of these agencies are still evolving, and yet that there is a difference. The learned are inserted in a different way to confuse us somewhat about the authority of the assembly. And I'm just wondering, having participated in a number of reflection meetings that somehow didn't involve consultation, but more or less announcing different goals and so on, and that's been frustrating. It's difficult to figure out exactly how consultation is working in this new kind of configuration of implementation of the 5-year plans. Could you help us a bit with that?
Well, friends, I as you know, I'm a foreigner. I just came from Haifa a few months ago. So I haven't lived here for a quarter of a century. So I don't know what you're doing these days. But I can tell you this. I can tell you this. That, as Baha'u'llah says, in all things we should consult. He's the one that has emphasized the importance of it. When you are in gatherings where that isn't done, you should insist upon it, because it is a principle of the cause. This is part of what has been given to you: frankness, candor, freedom of speech. And if the principles of the faith are not being applied, you don't have to participate in things where principles are violated. You should make your views known. But invite the practice of consultation. You expect the House of Justice to come down here and tell a local assembly to consult or tell some reflection group to consult, when in fact the whole point of the exercise is to consult. That's what reflection is all about, so far as I understand it. Now, I haven't been in reflection meetings. I don't know that I need to go to any of them. But I think that consultation is at the very heart of that whole idea of reflections, because I think we're supposed to be in a learning mode. And you can't learn unless you're discussing things among yourselves. And if there are those among you who stop you from consulting, you can kindly remind them, sorry, we are Baha'is here. We consult to understand things. Please allow us to do what Baha'u'llah has told us to do. And you'll see what happens. I'm done. This is the cop that came to get me.
Please thank Mr. Mitchell.